Okay, good afternoon. So as you probably know, today we're going to be covering exam review stuff, which is mostly going to be taking questions from you. If there aren't many questions, it'll be a short class. First, a little logistical note. There is an assignment that which on the schedule is released on Friday. Originally, it was due the week after spring break. I made it 2 weeks, partly because there's stuff I want to cover that we didn't get to on Wednesday for you to do the assignment, partly because it's a harder assignment than you're probably used to. It's likely substantially harder than tricky, and will probably therefore be worth twice as much as tricky. And I think tricky is what most of you found to be the hardest assignment so far. And it's like, the assignment is, here's a vulnerable executable, do stack smashing to make it print out a message of your choice. So with that out of the way, and so that assignment's 2 weeks after spring break, but you should know enough to start it when it's released on Friday. But we'll talk something about it Monday after spring break, things that might be helpful to know. So the exam portion format. So there's around 20 question parts in the drafts we have. I don't have it quite finalized. I've given something to my TA so they can come back to me and say, wait, that question's impossible or something. So it's mostly multiple choice or multiple choice. There's likely to be something on it that's similar to the RE assignment, but multiple choice. Something similar to the tricky assignment, but multiple choice. And something about anti-antivirus strategy, probably a bunch about anti-antivirus strategies, and maybe about VMs and some other things we talked about. There are things you don't need to memorize for the exam. Among them is all this assembly stuff. So this is what I'm planning on giving you in the first page of the exam. So all this information will be provided to you. And if there's other information I should provide that is of similar nature that's not here, please let me know. But I think all this is stuff I don't care about you memorizing. Yeah.
Are you going to put calling convention stuff on there as well?
It's at the top. Yeah, so there's calling convention reminder at the top, only the first two arguments. I'll put more on there if I think you need more. Yeah. If you need opcodes, they will be provided in the question. And similar is true for, you know, other things about instruction encoding. If you need information about that, we'll provide them in the question. Okay. So with that, let's see. So what questions do people want answered? I'll just collect them and then we'll sort them and go through them. Or reviewed, yeah. Okay, global table. Wow, this is a bigger screen than I'm used to. So let's make the font like actually big, because 18 is not big enough. So global tables and lazy binding. Yes. So mod RM and SIB. Okay. Yeah. Anti-debugging. Other topics? Yeah.
The differences between different types of VMs.
Different types of VMs. Yeah. Other things people want reviewed? Yes. Okay. Notation. Yeah.
Like an assembly reverse engineering example?
Assembly RE.
Maybe like the one that we did like earlier, just go over that again.
Yeah, I can pull up the actual one, but the RE assignment I can easily. I don't know if I have other examples lying around, but yes, assembly RE, other things, other topics that we should cover. I'll probably ask again later. Okay, so let's try to organize this. So we have a bunch of stuff about linking. We have something on encoding of instructions. We have EM technique. debugging. These probably go together. And we have stuff on assembly, like reading. Okay, so why don't we start with mod RM and SIB bytes. Yeah, or do you have one more? Rex, okay, rex dot blank, okay. So let's start with modRM and SIB. What are these things? How do they work? So the general x86 encoding, let's see if I can make this actually work properly, is that we have a prefix. What is so zero or more prefix bytes, followed by prefix bytes, followed by an opcode, and typically followed by a mod RM byte, and sometimes followed by an SIB byte. So the mod RM byte has three fields. It has a mod, which is mode, which is like, are we doing register plus displacement, or just register, etc. Are we doing memory at register plus displacement, or are we doing memory at a register value, or are we just doing a register value? That sort of information might be coded there, and we have RM and a reg. I'm not sure what order these are in. You'd actually look it up if you cared, or it would be on the test if you needed it. So RM bytes, these can have register numbers. So one case is that these both encode the registers of the instruction, and there's nothing else there. Another case is that we have instructions which are like, which have more registers, like this, and maybe something else. So here we have 1, 2, 3 registers, but here we had just 1, 2 slots for register numbers. So that's not enough. So for these instructions like where we have 3 register numbers, we use the SIB byte in addition to this reg here. So our two cases are that we get, or that for the 2 register case, we have an RM and reg byte, and we just use the opcode and the mod RM byte. Or we have 3 registers, in which case we use the opcode, the mod RM byte, and an SIB byte, and we use the reg number here, and in the SIB byte we encode, we have a scale, which is this, which an index and a base. So we use this base register, this index is a register number, and this reg in the mod RM byte is a register number, and the scale, it tells us about the 4 part here is the scale. So just they're different cases for how much we need to encode an instruction, which is the most confusing thing. So if we have like add RAX RBX, this is the light blue case where we need an opcode and a mod RM byte. If we have something like add RAX RBX 4 to RCX, let's say, that's the case where we need where we need all 3 of those bytes. the opcode, the monorem byte, and the SIB byte. Yes. So this is just about dealing with, so this is stuff which is the same on 32 versus 64. So this is, so all this stuff here is the 32-bit encoding. So it doesn't handle the 64-bit registers that were added by the 64-bit version of x86, which is anything but the first 8 registers. So for those registers, yes, that's the next thing, which is we need a prefix byte to give those register numbers. Yeah?
For instructions with 3 registers, does the 3rd register go on the scale index or base?
For the instructions with...
Does the 3rd register go on the scale and the index or the base?
So I've deliberately not told you what the assignments are because I don't have them memorized. The base is generally this register here, the one that's not multiplied by a scale. And the index is the one that is multiplied by a scale. And the scale is not a register number. It is this like 4 or 8 or 1 or 2 or 16. Well, there's no 16 or in the instruction. And the other reg number would be the other operand to the instruction. Yes. So the question, so you're saying we can't have register numbers in the mod, is that your first question? So the mod doesn't ever contain a register number, and there's two reasons for this. So one is it's 2 bits wide, so that's not big enough for even 8 register numbers. So the RM, sometimes, so the, when the RM doesn't have a register number, it has to have something, and what it has is just an indicator saying, hey, you need an SIB byte. Because we don't actually have another place to store that information. I haven't told you anything which tells us that. You could conceptually put it in the mod, but they didn't. So the way they do it is you set mod to a particular value, and you set RM to a particular value to say, hey, we're going to use an SIB byte for this instruction. So there's one particular value of mod and RM, the mod part of the mod RM byte and the RM part, which say there's an SIB byte after this. And if it doesn't have that value, you know there's not. Yeah, question?
If you were adding a constant to a register, would there be a mod RM?
If you were adding a constant to a register?
Add 4 to RM.
So if you're adding a constant to a register, I believe there is, I'm not sure if it's the same add instruction, but I believe there's a mod RM byte because we need one of the one register number. That's not always true. There's some instructions where the register number is in the opcode, which are special in that way, where they say, where the Intel manual says we basically may have a different opcode for each register that you could use. Another way of looking at it is the register numbers in the opcode. So other questions on this? I know this is still terse and confusing. Yeah.
So you don't need to put anything in the RM byte unless you're using an SIB byte?
You do. So the in the case where we have, so in this case where we have 2 registers, we're using the RM and the reg for them. So the RM contains a register number then. If you're using the SIB byte, you do still need to put something there. It's just not a register number. It's just a flag saying, this isn't a register number here. Use the SIB byte. There's also a case where for 2 registers, you might need to use an SIB byte because it happens that the register number you want to use is the flag. So you couldn't use an SIB byte when it, you could also use an SIB byte when it might not be necessary. Yeah. So if you have what I'm saying by that is when you have 2 register numbers, you just use a mod RM byte. And when you have 3, use a mod RM and an SIB. SIB is never alone. Okay. Other confusion? So the next question was about rex. So that's one of these prefix bytes. So we had our prefix bytes, and then our opcode, and then our register specifiers afterwards. And rex is one type of prefix byte, which has an indicator, so which is has some fixed value, which I don't remember, in the top bits. And then it has a some bits which have names like W and three other bits for which are extra register number bits. So an instruction that uses, say, R8, that is not a register number that existed in 32-bit x86. So we can't encode it directly using a mod or m byte, because if it, let's say, goes in the reg field of the mod or m byte, that's 3 bits, and we want to encode 1000. So what we do instead is we encode the 000 in the reg field, like, and we take this 1 and we stuff it in one of these prefix bits. And then we put this prefix here, this prefix at the beginning of the, before the opcode of the instruction. And we do the same for any other register number fields in the instruction. So that's the biggest, most important thing about this is that this lets us specify those other register numbers, despite the fact that our normal register fields aren't big enough. This gives us the extra bit. In a sane instruction set, they would already be in the instruction there. But this was designed by taking the 32-bit instruction set and adding something to it. And there's something added to it is that you put something before the opcode, which tells you about the extra bits. And when you later on find that register field, you just add it on. Yeah?
So if you were adding R8 to RAX, would it just put a 1 in a different one of those boxes?
Yeah, so each one of these boxes, so we can have up to 3 register numbers in an instruction. Each one of these boxes represents a different one of those. And you look at the tables to figure out which is which. I think they have names which are scale index and, or sorry, base index and register is the names, like which correspond to appropriately if there's an SIB byte. So the index and base fields of our rex, I think, correspond to that, and there's one for the other register. Yeah. So the W bit is not one of these bits. So that's separate. So, but yes, it would. So let's say, so these extra register bits occur regardless of whether the instruction is 64-bit or not. They just say, I'm using one of the registers besides the first 8 that 32-bit x86 supported. So then we have this W bit here, which stands for wide, conceptually. And so if W equals 0, then it's 32-bit. If W equals 1, then it's 64-bit. So this is how we distinguish between add L versus add Q. And similarly, how we distinguish between EAX and REX is by the presence of this, whether this W bit is set in a prefix. If it's unset, it defaults to 32-bit. So because we inherited from the 32-bit encoding, everything is 32-bit unless you add this special byte before an opcode and set the W bit in it to 1. Other questions about this confusion? I will move on to my next topic. So, global tables and lazy binding. So this is about linking, in particular dynamic linking. So in linking, we already have our assembly code compiled into machine code, but we're not quite done with something. And that still is playing. Okay. So, and a big distinction is that we had static linking. I should use black. We had static linking, which was to produce executables, and we were willing to do expensive stuff. And one of the expensive things we did is that we replaced pretty much every instance of a function address, or any address. So, we fixed it when we produced the executable to have the final address. We didn't know what it was until the final step of producing the executable. After we generated the machine code for each part of it, in our final step, we fixed all the parts of it to have the right addresses. In dynamic linking, we didn't want to do this. And this fixing, if you remember, was called relocation. So in dynamic linking, we want to minimize relocations. And so to minimize relocations, we had this stub concept. So we had a stub, which is that we replaced call printf was replaced at assembly time with call printf at static link time, call printf stub, and then we had a printf stub that basically is jump to global offset table at some index. So this is where our addresses are. So the trick we were doing is that the relocations are only in the global offset table. There's nowhere else we're doing these fixing of addresses. And we're doing that in dynamic linking, not because it would be wrong to do fix addresses everywhere, but just because it's faster. This is the strategy we chose. So we had these stubs, which is what we call the stubs, just look up an entry in this global offset table and jump there. So any questions on this part of the procedure? Yeah. Which brackets? Here? Some index.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, that's IDX for index. So some fixed index that's actually hard-coded in the stub. So that was that's the basic procedure. And the simplest thing to do would be to propagate this global offset table immediately. So our got had global offset table like has an entry for printf, and let's say puts, and let's say abort, and all the other functions we're using. And an observation we might make is that we don't need some of these entries most of the time. And we'd like to avoid looking them up if we don't need them. And so one solution to this is that instead of is that instead of resolving all these entries immediately, we can make this resolve to point to initially to a call get address of printf. So to some fixed code that we generate, which gets the address of each of these functions. So this is where it initially points. Get address of abort. And the idea is that in a typical execution, we do this. Done. But we don't do say getting the address of abort, because we usually don't call abort. And by being and the laziness is lazy is that we only do it only do resolution if needed. So linkers with lazy binding initially set up the table to just point to these dummy entries, which are just things which get the real address from the real library when you need it. And if you don't end up using one of those, the table entry will never change. So in the case of abort, if we never call abort, that table entry still points to get the address of abort instead of to the actual address of abort. But since we used printf, most likely, it probably points to somewhere in the library where there's a printf by the time our program finishes. And the savings of lazy binding is how many of these entries are like abort, things that we're not likely to use typically. The other savings is that our program startup is faster. So maybe we call, exit, but we don't waste time at the beginning of the program setting up our call to exit. We only do it when we actually need to call exit. Questions about this? Fusion? Other questions about dynamic linking or linking in general? Yeah. So the question is, where is this global offset table? So this is program data. So it's in the data part of what's the loaded program. And the initial value value is copied from the executable. So in the case where we're doing lazy binding, the initial value in the executable is going to point to these statically. And we're just going to copy that from the executable. In the case where we're not doing lazy binding, the initial value will be copied from the executable, but the first thing that will happen is the dynamic linker will fix it. But it's just part of the program data, just like a global variable. It probably is literally next to the global variables in memory. Yeah?
Is lazy binding less secure than loading them all at once?
So the question is lazy binding less secure than loading them all at once? And the answer is basically no. So there are things we're going to do with talk about doing later on when we talk about exploits that involve the global offset table, because it's a very nice target for various things where you might modify. But it's generally not going to matter how that was populated. The main reason I mentioned lazy binding is because if you're debugging programs, it's rather confusing to see, wait, that table entry points to this code which doesn't do anything? And you need to know why that happens. Any other questions? Okay, so what was our next topic? So different types of VMs, and I think I have slides for this one. So let's talk about all sorts of different types of VMs. So remember that virtual machines were about the illusion of a dedicated machine. And we had two sort of ways of classifying VMs. We had one way, which is about the interface they provide. What kind of machine are we simulating? Are we simulating something like a real machine, that system VM concept, something which runs a normal operating system? Or are we simulating something like what an operating system gives us, a process, something which has files and things like that? Or are we simulating something that a language gives us, something that has objects and classes? And there's, all these things are VMs, it's just a different kind of machine we're providing with different distances from real physical hardware. And for all of them, there are sort of three basic implementation techniques. And this last one I label this native, I might call this trap and emulate, is a common name for this, you'll see. So we have emulation. This is the simplest and slowest technique, but it is actually used, because it is simplest, is that you read an instruction and then you just have a giant if-else statement. So you find the opcode. If the opcode is 0x68, then do a push. If the opcode is 0x63, then do a return, and so on. Just have a big giant if-else statement. If you do emulation, it certainly works. It lets you handle any sort of type machine type, and it's probably like 10,000 times slower than the real thing. So the other strategy, which is as general as emulation, but considerably harder to implement, is binary translation. And here the idea is we take segments of machine code and we compile them to other segments of machine code. So we find a little bit of machine code that's, we know is going to run together, and we compile it to native machine code for whatever our target system is. Perhaps, you know, changing from one instruction set to the other, perhaps replacing a system call with a function call, doing whatever transformations we need to do, and we run that new machine code. So that's binary translation. We're taking one piece of machine code and making another in order to emulate a different machine. And the other one is native or trap and emulate, sort of what we consider normal VMs. Yeah?
Binary translation mean faster than emulation?
So the question is binary translation any faster than emulation? So it obviously depends on how you implement it. If your implementation of binary translation is copy and paste the if-else statement, it's going to be slower. Well-implemented binary translation is typically like 2 to 10 times slower than the real thing, versus emulation is like 1,000 times slower. So yes, a lot faster. Really well-implemented binary translation can be competitive with a hardware implementation after some startup time, or faster than the hardware implementation. If you're a compiler, because you're compiling, if you have a really good optimizer there, you can actually do better than typical hardware. So then we have native. So this is trap and emulate. So here, we rely on the virtual machine we're simulating being close enough to our real machine so that we can run the code natively in what is called user mode. And in user mode, certain privileged operations, like things operating systems expect to do, are going to not do something on the machine directly, but are going to call the operating system. They're going to trigger what's called an exception, and that's going to give the VM implementation control, and the VM implementation is going to handle that special operation in order to actually do what the virtual machine should do. And this native sort of implementation only works if the hardware will trigger exceptions on all the sorts of special operations we care about. If it doesn't, then we can't use it. We have to use one of the other techniques. So, questions on these? So that's the different kinds of VMs. So we had, interface, we had system, process, language, and we had implementation. We had emulation, which is giant if-else, is the way to think about it. It might not actually be an if-else, but that's basically what they're doing. Binary translation, which is compile machine code to new machine code. And native/trap and emulate, which is rely on hardware triggering OS code on special things. That was not the FS thing. We'll get to that. But that was like, so we mentioned one example. So like, we need everything that is special to trigger it. So we had a sort of counter example is popf used to do act differently in kernel versus user mode. So we had an example of an instruction which behaved differently in kernel versus user mode, but not by triggering OS in earlier x86. But it didn't trigger the OS. And that was bad because it meant we couldn't provide the interface popf is supposed to provide in the machine we're trying to simulate for a system VM. So that's where we have trouble, is when there's some operation which we want to do something special, which is just going to do something that's not, that we can't control, that isn't the right thing. And one example was popf, because popf is supposed to, you know, set a flag that the processor uses, but it actually just doesn't do it in user mode without doing anything else. And that was bad, because we wanted to pretend to set that flag in our virtual machine. So we needed extra hardware support to actually do that, which is what modern x86 has. Is that modern x86, for everything you want to do to implement a system VM, it has hardware support to trigger an exception on all those all the things that you would consider important to not do what the native hardware would do by itself. Okay. Other questions, comments, confusion? So our next topic on our list is anti-debugging. And when we talked about anti-debugging, we were talking about combating two different things that are is the biggest strategies that debuggers do. And one of them is breakpoints. This is sort of essentially the most important thing that I think for most people in debuggers is that breakpoints work. And that means that you can say there's a particular place in my program and I'd like to stop execution there. And the implementation strategy for breakpoints was that we'd have some code, and when we wanted to set a breakpoint, we'd change that code in memory. So if we wanted to set a breakpoint at this subqueue, we replace this subqueue with some other instruction that will give control to the debugger. And in in x86, this happened to be, I think, int 2? Something with hashing encoding of a fixed one byte encoding, which was important because it let us replace any instruction and not worry about overwriting a different instruction. Which is good because, you know, this next instruction here might be a loop label, and there might be a, you know, a jump to the loop down here, and that would be bad to overwrite it. Overwrite part of that instruction. So, but effectively, this is a, you can think of this as a jump to debugger. So this is how the debugger was typically implementing breakpoints. This is the most flexible strategy for implementing breakpoints because we can have as many as we like. We can just replace as many instructions as we like. It turns out this is jump to debugger and save old address. So we even learn where we jump from. It's all handled for us by the processor in this case. So the counter strategy is look for the OXCC, the jump to debugger instruction. So we know the debugger has modified our machine code to insert this jump to debugger instruction, so we can just look for it, see if it's there. And if it is, we know that something's up and we can do whatever we want to do to frustrate whoever's debugging our program. So a way to do this is just read the machine code and, for example, add it and see the same as before. So one strategy is just read every byte of the machine code, add it all together, see if the sum is the same as what we had when we wrote the program originally. And there's all sorts of other things you can do, but the central idea is you're looking for this inserted jump to the debugger. And there's, of course, a counter strategy. So as someone who's trying to debug a program which does this, what are you going to do? You're going to just replace the jump if I'm being debugged, bugged with an op. Just gonna get rid of it. But that takes some time to do, which is why malware authors want to do it. So questions on the breakpoint side of anti-debugging? So the other thing we cared about was single-stepping. And this is something we really wanted hardware support for, because without hardware support, single-stepping for an instruction like this, which is a computed jump, is really annoying. Basically, if you didn't have hardware support, the way you have to implement single-stepping because of things like this is you need to have an emulator that at least handled this instruction to figure out where does it go. So instead, we have hardware support, which on x86 is the TF flag, which means call debugger after every instruction. So you set this flag, and the processor will run one instruction and then call the debugger. When the debugger goes back to the program, it will run one instruction and then call the debugger. So this is not quite what single stepping does in our debugger, but our debugger just looks at what instruction we got to and decides whether or not it wants to tell us, hey, I stepped ahead a line. So the sort of counter strategies here are mess with the TF flag, which doesn't quite, hopefully doesn't work because the debugger gets control before the change happens. So the processor will run one instruction, go to the debugger with the TF flag now in set. So yes, it works, but it doesn't take effect until too late. But if the debugger doesn't reset the TF flag, this works. Or mess with the place where debugger calls go. And this also works for breakpoints. So if we can somehow register our own debugger that receives these calls to the debuggers that the processor makes, which is a handler for the TF flag exception, if you can tell the OS, hey, I'm debugging this program here, I would like to handle the single step thing myself, thank you, then we can interfere with the debugger that way. So, hey. So you tell the OS, hey, I'm gonna handle all these debugger calls. I know what I'm doing. And hopefully override what the debugger does. And the countermeasure is that measure is debugger blocks those calls. And the debugger just says no. It's just text that call, or the OS blocks those calls. Yeah. It depends on the OS. So this is like a system call, like opening a file. There's going to be some interface that the OS defines for doing this. In the most native, so on something like DOS, you actually have direct access to the thing the processor uses. So you can actually do the processor instruction that sets this up yourself. But on modern operating systems, you're going to have to ask the OS, and there's going to be some OS-specific interface for setting up debuggers, which varies between OSs tremendously. I hope that's clear enough. Other questions? Comments? Confusion? I think we have more. Yes. Okay. x86 segmentation. So the background for segmentation is that we have modern memory protection, which, if you know about it, is something called page tables, which is talked about late in 3330. This essentially says OS says. OS sets a mapping from program addresses to real addresses, including invalid regions, whole, etc. So page tables are a really flexible mechanism, and they're what all modern systems use. And you'll learn about that at the end of 3330. For this class, all that's important is that there's a really flexible mechanism to set up the address space, to define what addresses your program has access to, how they correspond to real memory. There's a really flexible mechanism for that, and that's page tables. But there's this historic mechanism called segmentation. And x86 supported it very early, and still does, and it's mandatory. So x86 has this older system in addition to page tables. And the way it works is that SES uses a segment number table. And there's a table which has tuples which are segment number, base address, and the limit. The access is OK. The access, so there's two steps. So first of all, the access address is program address plus base address. And the access is OK if program address is less than or equal to limit. So those are the two rules. So we have this table where we look at the segment number that the current access is using, which depends on what the instruction says in x86. So there's a default segment. And then we add this base address from this table, and we see if the program address was less than the limit. And that determines where we end up really accessing and whether the access is allowed. Yeah? Real memory address accessed. So the real memory address we access, which is actually before page tables, if you know what page tables are. So that's the way this is stacked on top of the other system, is that we do segmentation and then we do the modern stuff. Yeah.
Why?
Because they had to add it somewhere. And they couldn't get rid of segmentation.
How come?
They care about backwards compatibility, and DOS extensively uses segmentation. And OS2, I believe. So they actually really couldn't get rid of it. There were people who were using all the features of segmentation. So 64-bit mostly gets rid of it, but it still exists a little bit. So the modern use of OSs, almost all segment table entries are segment number 0 and max value. So modern OSs, most segment table entries have 0 base and a max value max, so they don't do anything. One exception, which is thread local storage, has a segment table entry, which is segment table, to storage, and max value. Has a segment table like this. So there's one entry, which is thread local storage, which has this pointer to some storage, and this is used for data for the current data. So this is basically an extra pointer register. Yeah. So the question is, are these segment table entries only settable by the operating system? So on modern OSs, yes. That doesn't mean there isn't a way for you to tell the operating system, hey, I'd like a particular segment table entry set up, but the operating system ultimately needs to set it. Yes?
So for thread local storage, can both FS and
GSV
use that?
So yes, so I'm getting to that. So yeah, so this is typically assigned to to FS or GS, which contain segment numbers, to thread local storage. So FS or GS. So Linux uses GS, Windows uses FS. Both of them can be used this way. And the way you, so using or GS looks like something like, and you saw this in an assignment, this is access OX28 using segment number FS, the segment number in the FS register, move to RAX. And this is the modern use, is that we want to access something in thread local storage, so we'll say access a fixed address based on the pointer that's in the segment table. And that's the only modern use of segmentation. Except that internally, you still need segmentation in the operating system, both the processor requires you to set it up, and some of the same data structures are used for very important OS things. Any other questions about this? Or other topics that people have questions about before we go on to assembly exercise? Mm-hmm. So the next topic is, someone would like to look over an example of doing RE. It's tempting like RE. I think I have, can make an example. Bad.c. Okay, so let's So let's go through a random example of some assembly code, this assembly, and see how we would figure out what things are in this function get number up here. So first thing you want to do is you want to find get number in our disassembly. So I'll just search for get number. Is that get number? Is that what I'm looking for if I want to figure out what the variables are? Shaking your head? It's the call, but.
Well, doesn't it have to put the variables in the right place?
So, doesn't what have to?
The call has to put the variables in the right place.
So, if there were arguments, yes. So this function here, yes. What arguments does it have?
It has zero, so it
belongs. So there's nothing to place. It has a return value. So where's that return value going to be after this call?
Yeah.
So it's going to be an EAX, which we can see is used here by moving move to ESI. So that's how the return value is used in this main. Let's go to the actual implementation of this function, which is down here. Not the call, but the thing that's labeled with the function name. That's where the symbol table says this function is. And we have our assembly here. So what would be a good strategy to figure out where how I is mapped to a register? What should we be looking for? What are some things? Yeah. So it's set to zero. So that's a good hint because I starts at zero. So we might say, okay, probably we're setting something to zero here. Does anyone see any setting values to zero? I see at least two. So back there.
XOR EBS.
So this one. So this XORing a value with itself, that's a way to set it to zero. So that's one possibility. So there's one other place where I see a value being set to zero. Yeah.
Is it the move EBXRBP?
So the move
zero into
the where? EBXRBP.
Yeah.
So you're saying maybe this sets something to zero? Yeah, and that looks like it does. Maybe EBX to RBP. Yeah, I guess that must do that. Okay. As we know, EBX is zero. So there's another case where we're definitely setting something to zero. The really obvious one. Yeah?
Zero.
Yes. So this one. So those are our possibilities for things that might be I based on being set to zero. So are there any other things we might be looking for happening with I? Yeah. What? Incrementing. Incrementing. So do we see any values being incremented here? Yeah. RBX. So RBX is actually incremented by an increment instruction. That's a pretty good hint. So that's a good candidate for being I. And there's no other obvious examples of values being incremented, at least that I can see. Yeah.
How do you know if I is RBX or EBX?
How do you know if I is RBX or EBX is the question.
They're the same.
They're the same value. So basically, it doesn't matter. And in the homework, we accepted both answers for that reason. And probably the biggest hint is how big is I? If you want to make a choice, how big is I? It's an int. And on this 64-bit Linux, typically ints are four bytes. So EAX is probably the better answer. Or EBX, I should say. So the other things we should look for is that if EBX/RBX is I, then we have to look at how is it being used. So we expect I to be used to index into buffer, because that is exactly what's happening here and here. So we should look for RBX or EBX, or any other name for parts of BX, RBX, being used to access memory. And we see right here that it's being used to access memory based on RSP and RBX, and based on, and later on, and so on. So we do see it, in fact, being used here. So this is probably means that this is accessing buffer at I++. So this should tell us where buffer is. So if I want to know where the beginning of buffer is, that's going to mean I is 0, assuming that this is, in fact, set to 0, like we think it is. So what is this access when I is 0? When RBX is 0. Yeah. Yeah, so this is when RBX is 0, this is 0xc plus RSP memory at that location. So that should be the starting point. So if we're right about what RBX is, if that's actually I, not something like I minus 1, then we know now where that this is the address of buffer 0. And we know how big buffer is, so that actually tells us exactly where all of buffer is stored. So we have this confusing thing down here. So we have this set of 0. So if that's not initializing I, what could it be? What in this code is going to set a byte to 0?
Setting the last character to the null character.
Yeah, so setting the last character for the null character. And it looks like in the code that setting, that set we expected to happen. If we look at this code, we can say, okay, where's I equals 0? Oh, it's this. Where's C equals get char? Well, it's there. And there's a loop which starts probably here. And there's the jump to the beginning of the loop. So this whole thing is a loop here. And we can see that this is where buffer of I+1 is set. This is the comparison to EOF. And this is the comparison to Yeah, sorry. And this comp and that JE is the comparison to new line in the original code, but we're missing the stuff afterwards. So we have a call to A to I, but before then we set the end of the buffer to zero. So that is probably being done by this, but we're not using RBX, we're using RBP. So how does that work? So why we're using RBP instead of RBX here. Otherwise it's the same. So how did RBP get set? Yeah. Yes, so we have a move up here, and that's where it got set. So it turns out that I is in both of these values, both EBX and RBP. So in the loop, I is RBX, and once we get out of the loop, I is RBP, or slash EBP. And yeah, for I'm not sure why the compiler generated this code, but this is something which happens. I guess presumably it has something to do with RBX being something that you can put in a register and not worry about being overwritten by the call to getChar, and RBP not being that. Okay, so I think that's most of an RE exercise. Are there other things that we did in RE that people want to go over? Or other things about reading assembly code in general? Yeah. So what was the question is, what is the flag to see the offsets? So object dump, if we pull up the manual and make it big, there's this flag here called file offsets, which very few people discover. Most people, I think, use GHEX. But there is a file offsets flag. And if you use the file offsets flag, and then you get information like, hey, get numbers at 0x5d6 bytes into the file. Most people use GHEX, which is perfectly fine and a perfectly reasonable skill to have, but yes, it is actually possible to get object dump to tell you about the address of the symbols and the file offset that every call and jump goes to. This is not the offset of the call, this is the offset the call would jump to. Yeah. So it's a difference of 400,000 in this executable. I can make executables where that's not true. There's nothing requiring the program to start at that address besides convention. And there's nothing which really depends on it. So yeah, I can make executables which start at other addresses. I guess it's not super well documented, but if you want to do that yourself, I think the easiest way of doing it is to write something called a linker script, which you can probably find examples of, usually used for things like building operating system kernels, which aren't linked like executables, but you can actually say, I want this at a particular address, and get it there. But yes, it turns out that the mapping produced by the default toolchain on Linux is very simple. So other questions? So I believe, if not, that is... So that's all we had questions about. Since I said it would be a short class, you didn't have questions. So other comments, questions, or am I done? Everyone ready for the exam on Wednesday?
I want to ask questions about this. I don't know
I guess I can pull up. I do not have a study guide put together. I don't have prior exams, and they wouldn't be like what I would write anyways. And giving you my rejected questions will not be representative of what's on the exam. Like, I could give them to you, but they're not what I'm going to write in the exam. Yeah. Select all that apply. Yes. On Colab, some of our TAs are a little bit behind on grading, which is why most of them aren't released.
Okay.
But some of them aren't. What? Yeah, three. As of this afternoon, the first three are released, but some of you don't have ASM grades released because some TAs are behind. And we'll be talking about that at our next TA meeting. So, okay. Other. Yeah.
What are the non-multiple choice questions going to be like?
I think my current draft is actually literally all multiple choice, but I'm not going to guarantee that that's going to survive until the next version. If it's not multiple choice, probably it would be something like write a number.
Okay, so it would be like a word answer.
Or like write a word, but like not anything which involves like writing code, because I don't want to grade that, or writing an essay about something subjective, because I don't want to grade that. Yeah. So the question is, for the tricky question, are you expecting to know the machine code? We will provide you with sufficient detail to figure out any machine code you need. So like on the assignment, we had a hand which said, this is how a push is encoded. This is how a ret is encoded. We will give you that sort of information if you need it. And you might not need it. We might ask you other things about tricky, like where do you put the jump? Okay. Other questions? Okay, I'll be here for the next last 5 minutes of class or so. Come up and ask if you were afraid to earlier.